As you might expect, keeping returning students safe is the biggest concern for college and university administrators across the country. That is one of the findings of a new survey conducted by the Princeton Review. Each year, the Princeton Review publishes their rankings of the best colleges in the country. The new survey on higher education in the COVID-19 era is an added part of that review. With some high-profile institutions rapidly closing just after opening for the new school year, we wanted to take a closer look at the findings. Here to talk about them is Robert Franek, the editor-in-chief of the Princeton Review. I asked when they took this new survey and who they spoke to.
Well, the survey is part of our book called The Best 386 Colleges, which is our annual college guide. But we reached out to the colleges in the book, the 386 schools. 179 of them got back to us, and we reached out specifically to administrators from the 386 schools in the book. Between July 1st and July 22nd is when we conducted the survey. It's 130 privates and 49 publics. So we're just hearing what their plans were for reopening academics, student health and safety, financial aid, really the works of what were going on campus at the time.
As you spoke to them, did you come across that there is a consensus on safety protocols in schools?
We did. Well, consensus on safety protocols. Administrators are focused in thinking about health and safety on campus as their primary focus, their biggest concern. Their speculation is that students and parents are focused on financial aid. So those are the two issues that they are trying to address so proactively. But from a health and safety perspective, that trickles down certainly to the classroom environment, but residence halls, dining halls, and then just regular life on campus. So those are the things that administrators were talking about.
And does it look like they all pretty much have the same ideas going in on how to keep people safe?
There are some consistent ideas, certainly around residence halls, limiting the number of students in a traditional residence hall, whether it's first-year students or seniors. So that is nearly universal. Dining hall plans sort of waver, definitely a low intensity when it comes to student population on campus. Many of those students will simply pick up meals, whether it's, breakfast through snacks right at the end of studying time. So those things are consistent as well. But some schools are just adding in things that are, outliers. There are several schools that have dining hall robots that were introduced before the COVID pandemic, but that are now being utilized fully, both front of the line delivery services, as well as back of the house cleaning and sanitizing.
You did this in July. We're now in mid-August recording this, and things have already changed. Two very high-profile schools opened up and then said, never mind, UNC Chapel Hill and Notre Dame. Do you think that's going to continue? You think some schools are going to say, we just weren't ready?
Well, we're certainly saluting the schools that are able to say, hey, this was our plan in the beginning part of the summer or the end of the school year, but we need to shift these plans for health and safety reasons. So I do understand that that's going on campus. Even our survey was reflecting that for fall, the majority of administrators that completed the survey, 67% of them said that they would have some sort of hybrid offering, so a mixture between in-person and online. I expect that those numbers are going to continue to increase as we move closer to the fall and certainly into the first few weeks in the semester.
Is enrollment down in schools, or is it up, or is it just the same like nothing is happening?
Well, there are a number of schools. That was one of the big questions that we asked administrators, 39% of whom were expecting that there would be lower enrollment for not only for their first year class, but for all classes at the school. 42% said this is going to stay the same, and 19% said it was going to be higher, which is probably not too surprising. Many students are, for health and safety reasons, discussing with their parents, maybe I should stay 2 hours from home driving rather than 2 hours on a plane.
Are schools adjusting tuitions if they're going to be, just distance learning?
There are several schools that are adjusting tuition, and that is, again, policy that continues to form. Whether students are going to be completely online, hybrid, or some mixture of or in the classroom fully, we are seeing several schools. There are still the outliers that are saying, let us offer you a tuition discount. What many schools are doing, however, Bob, is limiting or adjusting student fees significantly, whether those are fees for on-campus services or other services. So that's something that we're following pretty closely at Princeton Review, too.
Oddly, and I do this as an aside, my daughter is going to a state college here in Florida, and when I took a look at her bill, there's a distance learning fee attached to it. Is that happening elsewhere?
There are a handful of schools that have very recently added in the distance learning fees, and schools are pretty quick to underscore why that fee exists. And again, there are still a relative handful of schools that have added in that fee. But when schools made the shift back in mid-spring, you know, from face-to-face learning to online learning so quickly, and now there were some certainly things that had gone on that were of great benefit to students, but then some learning that happened on the part of schools. Those fees are there to help ensure that students are going to get the best experience online and that teachers during the summertime will have been trained to do just that.
Does all this adjust the way you rank schools in the book?
Well, it's a good question, and I appreciate you asking. We go directly to students and ask them their experiences. So although we have great experience with schools and from the academic side, certainly to the quality of life side at Princeton Review, we go to whom we consider experts of their own experiences. Those are students. We surveyed from September of 2019 till just about March of 2020. So yes, we are continuously surveying students right now and certainly going into the academic year, and we'll continue to hear it. But I suspect that students are going to have an opinion about their experience academically and otherwise come the next year.
It'll be interesting to take a look at the difference in rankings from this book to next year's edition.
It will. And again, those experiences are happening right now. And I think we're going to know much more certainly over the next couple of weeks when schools in earnest will open hybrid or otherwise.
You talked about administrators thinking that students' biggest concerns will still be financial. Are students telling you that?
Without question, we hear from students and their parents and then counselors helping them along the way, high school counselors, independent counselors, and the like. And we are just hearing that throughout the summertime. We heard it at the end of the spring semester, but then throughout the summertime. And I think rightfully so. So many families, as you know, Bob, are affected by COVID-19 from a financial perspective. And how are schools adjusting their financial aid packages? Are they adjusting their tuition dollars, as we've discussed? And how are they addressing students who are entering class right now for the fall 2020? But I think even so important for our students at Princeton Review are the fall class of 2021 and beyond. What is the financial aid makeup going to be for those students and their parents? And that's issues that are top of mind for those students and families.
And in your discussions with students, is the loss of the classic college experience in the forefront of their minds?
It is crushing, Bob. I mean, soul crushing for so many students, who exited, college so quickly, or for those students who were in high school now as first year students coming onto campus this fall. They are all so clear with us, reaching out to Princeton Review on their surveys and through our social media. We're getting so many comments on students wanting to go back to the campus, wanting to be in a classroom with other students, wanting to have interaction with faculty members. And they are quick to say that although they appreciate the hybrid model and the online efforts that are there to build community, and it can happen online, but students and their parents and faculty want to be back in that classroom with face-to-face learning. So although I think the hybrid model will continue, I don't think that we're going to see it at the level that we're seeing it right now after the pandemic crests.
I'm seeing, again, we're recording this in mid-August, and we're seeing a lot of stories now about student move-in days to campus, and they're still moving into dorms, but the majority of their classes are going to be online. That's an interesting dynamic.
It is such an interesting perspective, and you're right. Harvard had announced just about 3 or 4 weeks ago that it was going to have first-year students onto campus for the first semester. They would then exit after the Thanksgiving break. They'd be replaced by seniors come the spring semester, and although they would be on campus in a safe and socially distant environment, all of their classes would be held online. And so many schools are at least starting to follow that model or some close variation of that model as we move on to campus. So, comparing last year, 2019, to this year, it truly does feel like apples and oranges. But I try to reassure my own students and just say, listen, this is going to be temporary. And to pat them on the back and say, they have weathered such tectonic shifts in their experience academically, and they've done really well. I mean, these students are the most resilient I've ever seen, ready to take on, work academically and otherwise, virtually or otherwise, and I just applaud them for it.
Robert Franek is the editor-in-chief at the Princeton Review. You can find links to the study on the Best of Our Knowledge page at wamc.org. Well, we just spoke about colleges and universities welcoming back students for the new semester. Those move-in days look quite a bit different this year. I stopped by to see how things were moving along at the University of West Florida.
I was thankful that they kept campus open for us, and I can't wait for the school year to start.
Lindsay Casey is a returning sophomore at UWF. She was just one of the students moving in and getting ready for the fall semester. She said she had no doubts about coming back to campus.
They said that they had some protocols that they were going to put in place, but coming back to campus wasn't ever a second thought for me. I know that they were going to put the safety and health of the students first.
Move-in day is usually a festive occasion on the UWF campus, with student organizations serving drinks and snacks and volunteers helping arriving students move furniture and baggage into their dorm rooms. This year, things are very different. To avoid unnecessary contact and to let families stay together longer, there are no volunteers to help with the move. Plus, move-in day has become move-in week, with students getting assigned times on different days to come on campus and check in.
We actually started this probably at the beginning of the summer, I'd say back in May.
Dr. Kim LaDuff is Vice President for Academic Engagement and Student Affairs and Chief Diversity Officer at UWF. She says planning for the semester was difficult because back then they could not be sure where the region would be in terms of the pandemic.
We're at a point now that we know, you know, we're requiring that students wear masks in the classroom and in any public spaces. We have put guidelines in place for their interactions in housing, that they shouldn't be congregating in large groups. And we have signage every place, you know, reminding them of that. And so we really do hope that students will take heed and really listen and cooperate with us. And so far, so good. We've been really pleased to see our students coming in with their families. When I drove in this morning, I saw an entire family walking across campus with masks on, and that's an accomplishment in this heat.
So in our bag, we have a 4-ounce thing of hand sanitizer, a thermometer, a no-touch tool that helps them open up doors or, you know, locks, and then 3 different types of face masks. So hopefully they'll find at least one in here that they like and is comfortable for them during the year.
Bryce Griffin was handing out these welcome bags to arriving students. To check in, new arrivals drove through a series of tents and checkpoints so they could complete the process without getting out of their vehicle. Rachel Hendricks is a volunteer at tent number 1.
This is the first stop. They come up and we make sure that they are here for their assigned check-in time. We make sure they have a parking pass so they can go on through and park in the appropriate residence hall. And if they have any visitors, we're giving them visitor passes as well.
After that, they drive to the second checkpoint where they may encounter Jennifer Nagum.
Here we officially check them into our system that they've arrived, and we record their key number and deliver their key to them.
The last stop is where they get their goodie bags and then drive off to their dorms.
It's actually pretty orderly. I like it.
UWF President Dr. Martha Saunders was on hand to help greet the new and returning students. She says that even though many students will be living on campus, classes this year will be different.
More than half of our courses are completely online, and then we have a small percentage of in person, and then the rest are what we call a hybrid, but a mix. I'm teaching a course. I will spend the first 3 weeks on Zoom. We'll get to know the students. We'll do some foundational work. And then we'll figure it out.
The University of West Florida previously announced that all classes will transition to distance learning after the Thanksgiving break this semester. As for next semester, Dr. Kim LaDuff says it's a work in progress.
At this point, we have a task force that we're weekly meeting and just sort of assessing where we are in the state, where we are in the country, and how that impacts us as a campus. And so, yes, we haven't made final decisions about that yet, but I would think that, you know, we'll probably have some decisions in place middle of this semester.
And while last year the university had a waiting list for their dormitories, this year the dorms are about 78% full. Still to come, there's more than one way to test for the coronavirus. That's next on the Best of Our Knowledge. Got got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Testing for COVID-19 is an important part of getting a handle on the current pandemic, but testing for the virus itself may be only half the story. Measuring the antibodies that are formed due to coronavirus infection may also be useful for detecting individuals who presumably have had the disease and have since recovered. Within weeks of the declaration of the COVID-19 pandemic, literally hundreds of test kits for detection of antibodies to the novel coronavirus have flooded the market. And just as quickly, the accuracy of some of these procedures has been called into question. A paper appearing in the August 2020 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry examined several of these assays in an attempt to validate their performance and validate the manufacturer's claims. Two of the authors of that paper are Dr. Mason Tang and Dr. Christopher Farnsworth. They're both from the Department of Pathology and Immunology at Washington University in St. Louis. So, Dr. Tang, what is the difference between testing for the novel coronavirus itself, the so-called diagnostic tests, or serological antibody tests?
Yes, so diagnostic tests in general are those that should be used for acute diagnosis of SARS-CoV-2. As of right now, this is done by molecular techniques, primarily PCR assays, to detect RNA from the virus. So these are usually done on nasal swabs and sometimes saliva. And these assays can tell if viral particles are present in your respiratory tract, but they cannot differentiate if the detected viral particles are infectious or not. In contrast, serological assays are blood tests that detect circulating antibodies to SARS-CoV-2. And as you mentioned, antibodies are formed following viral infection. And because of the memory component of our immune system, these antibodies can circulate for months or sometimes years, but their levels may actually reduce over time. So the presence of these antibodies indicates previous exposure to the virus. But one of the most important differences between molecular and antibody tests is that professional societies, including the CDC, the FDA, the WHO, and the Infectious Diseases Society for America, do not advocate for the use of serological assays for an acute diagnosis of COVID-19.
Dr. Farnsworth, there's been quite a bit written in both the lay press and in scientific journals on the accuracy of serological assays for COVID-19. Can you tell us how your study fits into the situation and with the other literature?
Sure. So we began planning our study prior to the FDA requiring emergency use authorization for serological assays for SARS coronavirus 2. Since these assays were not meant to be diagnostic, the FDA allowed companies to sell their assays without thorough vetting. The underlying assumption was that tests would be run by high complexity laboratories, mainly for seroprevalence studies. However, an unintended consequence of this ruling was that dozens of assays quickly became available, most of which with very small or no studies having been performed to assess their accuracy. At the time we were planning our study, there was also nothing in the published literature that compared various commercially available serological assays for accuracy. However, there was considerable coverage in the lay press questioning the accuracy of these early serological assays, particularly lateral flow-based methods from relatively unknown manufacturers.
Okay, well, let's get down to it. What do you think are the main take-home messages from your study?
So first, we found that all three commercially available assays that we compared had low sensitivity early after the onset of symptoms. In fact, of the three assays we assessed, the highest sensitivity between 3 to 7 days of symptomatology was only 40%. This is important for two reasons. First, in our hospital, the median time to presentation for patients with COVID-19 is 3 days from symptom onset. Therefore, the diagnostic utility of serology is very low for symptomatic patients presenting to our hospital. Secondly, there's some evidence in the literature that key interventions for patients with COVID-19 are early during infections. Together, these indicate that serological testing is not adequately sensitive at early time points to be used as a diagnostic test for SARS coronavirus 2 infections. Our second main finding is that the sensitivity of each of the assays assessed was lower than that stated in the package insert claims by the manufacturers. This is most likely due to differences in patient populations. Our hospital treats mainly acutely ill patients, including those with cancer, are immunocompromised, or have other chronic diseases. Furthermore, the vast majority had acute infections. We intentionally selected this patient population due to the concern that this assay would be used to attempt to diagnose hospitalized patients with COVID-19 infections. Finally, we observed that these assays, despite differences in antigenic target, assay design, and method, performed largely similarly. There were minor differences in sensitivity and specificity, most of which have now been replicated by other studies. These differences may be relatively negligible depending on the patient population being tested.
You submitted your paper in May of 2020, and here we are recording this in mid-August. Your hospital has presumably started testing patients for the presence of SARS-CoV-2 antibodies. Dr. Tang, in your experience, just how are the serological assays being used by clinicians?
Yes, so you're absolutely right. It has been slightly more than 3 months since we have started using this assay in our hospital lab. And of the non-study specimens, most of them, approximately 80%, were performed on outpatients. We think that these outpatients are typically patients who are generally well, but are curious about their antibody status. Serving these curious well patients is somewhat of a new situation for us. Since we are a hospital lab, our efforts have always been directed towards generating lab values that can be used for clinical decision making. So for example, when we test a patient for antibodies against measles or hepatitis, that information is also being used to establish presumptive immunity in the workplace or to determine if other actions are necessary, such as administering additional booster vaccines. But we are now seeing COVID serology being ordered for patients who simply wanted to know if they've been exposed to the virus.
So to reiterate Mason's statement, as a hospital lab, one of our primary goals is to ensure that appropriate testing is available for hospitalized patients. To this end, we really had two primary concerns with serological assays. The first was that providers would attempt to use them to diagnose acute infections. The second major concern we had was that serological assays would be used to determine if a patient had acquired immunity to SARS-CoV-2 or an immunity passport. To help curb this, we provided considerable education for providers, including newsletters, communication through our hospital's incident command center, and links out of the electronic medical record to help providers understand other limitations with these assays. These have been largely successful in that we anticipated copious orders for COVID serology, however, have only received a small daily trickle.
Well, finally, let's look ahead. What do you think the role for antibody testing will be in a few months or even a year from now?
So this is a really great question, and really the $1 million question as if results from serological assays can be used to infer if a patient is protected from future infections with SARS coronavirus 2. According to the FDA, and consistent with the published literature, this is not currently known. However, if this can be proven and appropriate assays shown to be a proxy for protection, then there could certainly be a role for testing patients with previously known infections for antibody concentrations to the virus. But again, to be clear, this is not currently known, and I'm not necessarily advocating for this role of serology at this time. Another potential utility of serological assays could be after the emergence of vaccines to SARS coronavirus 2. Serological assays have been used for this purpose for other viruses to confirm vaccination history. For example, we use this now for measles. Once again, this will require an optimized assay for this purpose. Finally, one current utility where serology is possibly being underutilized in patients are those with signs and symptoms of COVID-19 that are persistently negative by PCR testing. This is especially true of patients who've had symptoms greater than 14 days. Serology could actually be helpful in the subset of patients to distinguish COVID-19 infections from other potential causes of disease. So that's actually one use right now where serology could have a positive impact on patient treatment.
That's Dr. Christopher Farnsworth and Dr. Mason Tang from the Department of Pathology and Immunology at Washington University in St. Louis. Their paper appears in the August 2020 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry. The coronavirus pandemic has certainly disrupted life for just about everyone, but it ain't the Black Death. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Where do we look for historical insight on the current pandemic? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Michael Vargas, professor of medieval history at SUNY New Paltz, compares COVID-19 to the period of the Black Death.
4 years after arriving into Italian ports in 1347, the Black Death had killed about half of Europe's population, around 100 million people. And yet, the pandemic did not cause an economic unraveling. Laborers, suddenly in short supply, saw their wages rise, but only until their lords forced wages back down. Poverty and food insecurity existed before and after the plague, all the while the rich held extravagant banquets. Normally, when kings and princes went to war, the spilled blood was not their own. For most of the living, then as now, greed, war, and political infidelity hit harder than pandemic. What about the Black Death's psychological effects? Late medieval images of dancing skeletons taking people to their graves offer poor evidence of post-plague trauma, since similar art has always helped to negotiate everyday anxieties about life's end. Fearmongers exploited anxieties, as they do today. Conspiracy theories about Jews poisoning wells during the plague were wrong, but they worked to reaffirm boundaries. In the midst of any pandemic, the historical evidence may be with contemplatives who say, "This too shall pass," as also with scientists who remind us that we are an adaptive species. So we can get over COVID-19 and go back to normal. But history also whispers back at itself. Can we do better? We can go back to our work to buy, push down to move up normal if we want to. But we always have an alternative, a ready supply of sustainable humane inventiveness, of charity and goodwill. Crises give us the opportunity to live a new and better normal, if we choose it.
That was Michael Vargas of SUNY New Paltz. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.